We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
I'm Josh Hammer, and welcome back to America on Trial, your one-stop shop for all your legal news pertaining to the 2024 presidential election and all the major pressing legal headlines affecting our country and our American way of life. On today's show, we're going to go to New York City for our deep dive today. What's going on with Judge Juan Merchan? Trump's trying to get him recused from the so-called hush money criminal prosecution, the case brought by Soros funded DA Alvin Bragg. Is he going to be successful? Moreover, should the judge recuse himself? We're going to get into all that and more in today's deep dive later on the show. And then later on, to cap off the show with today's closing argument, the state of Oregon has done a dramatic and remarkable 180-degree turn on the issue of drug decriminalization. Fascinating stuff from an iconic blue state. What does it say? What does it say moving forward for social trends about drug decriminalization and quality of life issues? There's a lot to unpack there. All of that in the show later on. But for now, as always, we're going to start by going around the horn. We begin for now in New York City. We will return to New York City later on the show. But for now, today was the day, given the 10-day deadline from the reduced bond payment. Today was the day when that $175 million bond payment from Donald Trump and the Trump Organization was due. As we've discussed on the show previously, Don Hankey, a billionaire based in California, has provided that $175 million bond to the Trump Organization. For now, the Trump Organization has used straight cash as collateral to attain that bond from Don Hankey's insurance company. So the next steps is that we're going to have an actual appeal, and Trump's going to get an opportunity to appeal that $450 to $60 million in damages and liability, that absolutely insane ruling from Justice Arthur Engoron. He's going to get his shot on appeal. Right now, we don't know exactly when that is going to take place, but hopefully sooner rather than later. And I continue to personally hope, as someone who is a native to New York State and still has a lot of friends and family in the area, I hope that the judges on that appellate panel have some semblance of sanity and some awareness of the harrowing and pernicious long-term repercussions if they go ahead and let this ruling stand. It really is dangerous stuff. At a certain point, it ceases to be about Donald Trump and the Trump Organization, and it starts to be really about entrepreneurship and capital flowing into New York State and things like that. Going from New York down to Washington, D.C., just another reminder that Monday is the deadline for Jack Smith's response, for special counsel Jack Smith's response to Donald Trump's lawyer's argument at the United States Supreme Court when it comes to the big question of immunity. That's getting argued at the U.S. Supreme Court on April 25th, later this month. That's the huge showdown on the scope of presidential immunity. What is the scope of presidential immunity that would preclude future criminal prosecutions of an ex-president after he leaves office? Well, Jack Smith's going to lay out his argument in his brief. He probably will take an exceedingly narrow view of immunity to the extent that he acknowledges it at all. It will probably be a similar argument to what the three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit ruled in a troubling ruling that took a very narrow conception of presidential immunity. But all of this is gearing up for this huge argument at the court on April 25th. I certainly know that we're excited for that right here on America on Trial. And then going from D.C. to Georgia, just another brief reminder that next Thursday, if you've been thinking that the Georgia trial, wow, what's going on with Fonnie Willis? I mean, this trial was all the news that's fit to print for a long time, and now suddenly no one's talking about it. Well, that's because it's currently just being slow-walked. And Scott McAfee, the trial court judge who divined that bespoke remedy, he basically said that Trump has a right of immediate appeal to an appellate panel to see whether Fonnie Willis can actually be disqualified. Fonnie Willis is going to actually have her say as to whether the appellate court should not even hear this, and that she obviously has to remain on the case, and therefore the trial should start. Her legal filing is due in court to that effect a week from today, next Thursday, April 11th. So we should have some clarity as to what is going on in Georgia over the next 2 to 3 weeks. All of this, again, is being slow walked just a little bit because Scott McAfee allowing that certificate of immediate review, allowing Trump to appeal the possibility that Fonnie Willis might actually end up being disqualified from this case, as I continue to believe that she should be. going briefly over to the great state of Texas. Y'all know that one of the things that we've been tracking on the show is Texas's excellent immigration statute, SB 4, which ideally would tee up a direct challenge at the U.S. Supreme Court to a misguided 2012 U.S. Supreme Court case called Arizona versus United States, which totally flunked constitutional law 101, essentially said that in that particular case, Arizona, and for present purposes, the state of Texas, really have no ability to enforce immigration law in any way because the federal government, according to this line of sight, has unambiguous plenary authority to do so, and the state cannot supplement that authority in any way when it comes to immigration enforcement. Totally bat crap crazy stuff. We live in a system of dual sovereignty where both the states and the federal government are sovereign within their own areas of legitimate legal jurisdiction. What that means for practical purposes is that Texas 100% unequivocally has the right to secure its own sovereignty, especially so when the federal government is not doing so. Well, yesterday in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, the right-leaning federal appellate court that I myself clerked on 6 years ago or so, the Solicitor General of Texas, Aaron Nielsen, was making his case before the three-judge panel. It would be Chief Judge Priscilla Richmond of the Fifth Circuit, Judge Andy Oldham, and Judge Ramirez, a liberal-leaning Biden nominee. This panel split 2-1. About a week and a half, 2 weeks ago or so, to let SB 4 continue to not be enforced for the time being. It was the hearing yesterday where they are ultimately going to rule as to the substantive merits of this law. It's going to head to the Supreme Court almost assuredly one way or the other. I am personally very excited for that as an immigration law nerd myself. But it seems like the oral argument didn't go amazing for the Solicitor General of Texas, Aaron Nielsen. At what point it seems like the Solicitor General, Aaron Nielsen, conceded the possibility that, quote, maybe Texas went too far with SB 4. He's a former professor. Aaron Nielsen, who's now the Solicitor General of Texas, is a far better, I'm sure, appellate advocate than I am, much more experienced, yada, yada, yada. But maybe you don't want to actually say that your state went too far. Just perhaps that's not a great line of argumentation. In any event, Judge Andy Oldham, who is a rock-solid conservative, is almost assuredly going to rule with Texas in this case. So that leaves Chief Circuit Judge Priscilla Richmond to be the swing vote. We will see what ultimately happens of that. But for now, just be aware that that argument happened in the Fifth Circuit yesterday, and we are awaiting further word on that. Hopefully a ruling in the not-so-distant future in this extremely important matter, Texas's crucial SB 4 immigration law. From Texas to Florida, Axios has a scoop, and this has been rumored for a while now. Trump is on track for a huge fundraising haul this weekend, this Saturday night in Palm Beach. They're looking at possible $43 million in funds raised in this billionaire dinner that is going to be in Palm Beach in order to get to the chairman level of this, quote, inaugural leadership dinner, according to Axios' sources. That's going to cost you $824,000. There are expected to be many luminaries at this dinner, so at least three of President Trump's former competitors in the Republican presidential primary. That'll be Senator Tim Scott, Vivek Ramaswamy, and North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum. Any number of other billionaires are expected at this dinner as well, very much including the noted Trump supporter and hedge fund billionaire John Paulson. So if this is true, and if this actually is executed according to what Axios is scooping and what has been rumored for a while, $43 million. Wow. I mean, like, huge. I mean, how do you even quantify that? And blows out of the water, if it actually comes to fruition, blows out of the water the $26 million that was just raised by President Joe Biden last week at that Radio City Music Hall event, the one with Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and Lizzo, the one where Trump simultaneously was going to the wake of the horrifically slain NYPD cop while Biden was yucking it up with all the who's who and the liberal Twitter people and Lizzo and Obama. So $43 million. Wow. Good for Donald Trump and the Trump campaign if they can pull that off. A lot of that will probably go to helping the former president, Donald Trump, cross-subsidize his legal fees, which are rapidly mounting. Finally, the last bit of news for today's Around the Horn segment. We go out to California. Another bit of news that we are closely tracking here in America on Trial, we did our deep dive on it fairly recently, is the continuing persecution of my friend John Eastman out in the state of California, or for that matter, really all around the country, because John is, of course, a criminal co-defendant in the state of Georgia as well in the Fannie Willis case. But in California, you had a judge there who, in a 100-plus page ruling, recommended that John Eastman be disbarred from California. This is a man, John Eastman, who one clerk on the United States Supreme Court for Clarence Thomas back in the 1990s, two, has been a prolific legal scholar over the course of his entire career, three, was former dean of a law school, for God's sake. He was a dean of Chapman Law School in Orange County, California. And now the State Bar of California is saying that he should be disbarred for being an insurrectionist, for the legal advice that was well within the bounds of what a client can offer in his zealous advocacy of a client. They are now saying that he should be disbarred. Well, just yesterday, John Eastman filed a formal filing in California that is requesting the judge who wrote this 100-plus page disbarment ruling to stay her own orders, that he can continue his work as a lawyer, and ultimately to fund his criminal defense. This persecution of John is disgusting on a personal level, and much like the Tish James Stalinist persecution in New York, it says everything you need to know about the way that the left and the modern Democrat lawfare complex actually feels. Their rhetoric to the contrary notwithstanding, it tells you all you need to know about how they actually feel about the so-called rule of law and democracy in America. And let me tell you, it is not pretty. That's it for today's Round the Horn segment. Up next in today's deep dive, we're going back to New York City. What's going on with Justice Juan Merchan and the hush money payment case? We're going to get into all that and more. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga, Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
What is the No Spin News all about?
You know that this is a fact-based analysis news program. You know that. We avoid speculation. We don't do conspiracies here. We don't do party politics here. We're not nonpartisan. That's wrong. Not that. Okay, we are advocates for a stronger America and a more just society. We don't believe in communism. We don't believe in socialism. We don't believe in nihilism. We don't believe in the progressive woke culture. We think it is un-American. We don't support that. So you should know what we are, and it would then crystallize what we do.
Listen to the No Spin News. Subscribe to Bill O'Reilly's podcast feed wherever podcasts are available.
Welcome back. It's time for today's deep dive. So as we get closer to the April 15th starting date, that is 1 week from Monday, folks. That is coming up real quick. April 15th is obviously tax day, not a particularly fun day for many of us, and it's doubly not going to be a particularly fun day, at least as of right now, for Donald Trump, because that is when jury selection voir dire starts in the first of the criminal trials that he is facing, and potentially going to be the only criminal trial that he faces prior to the November 2024 presidential election. That, of course, remains to be seen, but it is certainly going to be the first out of the gate. This is the so-called hush money payment case involving Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels. You know the drill by now. Michael Cohen pays off this $120,000 to $130,000 or so, give or take, payment to Stormy Daniels, so-called hush money, on the eve of the 2016 presidential election. The feds, the Southern District of New York, looked into possibly prosecuting Donald Trump on these grounds. Alvin Bragg, the local prosecutor, the DA in Manhattan, his predecessor, Cy Vance Jr., also looked into possibly prosecuting Trump on these grounds. Both the feds and Cy Vance Jr. passed on doing so. Alvin Bragg, because he is a far-left Soros-funded hack, has no compunctions whatsoever and has felt free and liberated to do, and so he has done. We still have no idea exactly what his theory of the case is, because you have a statute of limitations in place for the actual underlying criminal statute, which is fraudulent bookkeeping. So in order to get around the statute of limitations while simultaneously trying to get this, what would otherwise be a misdemeanor, up to a felony, Alvin Bragg has to legally argue that the alleged fraudulent bookkeeping, aka the hush money payments, he has to argue that that was done in furtherance of X, in furtherance of insert your crime du jour here. Yes, that's right. Alvin Bragg literally has not told us exactly what that crime is. And that is just astounding. We have reason to believe, in fact, we do believe that the actual allegation is that it is in furtherance of campaign finance laws or election laws or things like that. But it is remarkable that here we are on the eve of the commencement of the first ever criminal prosecution against a former president of the United States, and we literally do not know exactly what the prosecution's legal theory of the case is. I cannot underscore enough just how bat crap crazy that is. In first world countries, it seems to me like something like that simply should not happen. And not enough people, I think, are crying foul over that in and of itself. But yesterday was a busy day in the courtroom of the presiding judge here, Judge Juan Merchan. So he denied President Trump's latest attempt, admittedly something of a last-minute Hail Mary attempt, to invoke presidential immunity to get this prosecution either kiboshed, either quashed in the first instance, or more practically, to at least have its commencement delayed until the United States Supreme Court rules on the scope of presidential immunity in the Jack Smith probe. That ruling at the U.S. Supreme Court probably wouldn't come down until the end of June. So if Merchan were to go ahead and accept this argument of Trump's, it would have had the effect of delaying this trial by about 2.5, probably almost 3 months or so. So he denied that. He denied just yesterday in court Trump's attempt to delay this thing until the U.S. Supreme Court rules on the scope of immunity. This is part of what Justice Juan Merchan wrote. He wrote, quote, "The defendant had ample notice that the people were in possession of and intended to use the various statements allegedly made by defendant on social media, in public, and in various interviews. He was also well aware that the defense of presidential immunity, even if unsuccessful, might be available to him." So they're basically saying that he attempted this too late, that he tried to do this too late. I don't predict that in an alternative universe that he would have been successful in invoking this defense anyway, but at a bare minimum, the judge here, Merchan, is saying that he simply raised this too late. Another excerpt from Merchan's writing, he writes, quote, "This court finds that defendant had myriad opportunities to raise the claim of presidential immunity well before March 7th, 2024. In fairness, he probably has a point there. If that actually was when Trump's lawyers raised this, it certainly seems to me like there was no reason that they could have not done so more recently. And as of now, it looks like Merchan is basically doubling down. He's basically doubling down here. He had other language in this writing that he produced yesterday saying that this is a purely personal act of Donald Trump's. This has nothing to do with official acts. So even regardless of what the Supreme Court says, when it happens to come to it, to its ultimate finding of the scope of immunity, it's not going to have any implication here because he wasn't even a president yet back when the hush money payment stuff happened in 2016. He was just a candidate. This is purely personal conduct, has nothing to do with official conduct. So a lot of flowery language like that. But the real question hovering over Justice Juan Merchan is, should he actually have to recuse himself from this case? That is what Donald Trump's lawyers are, again, currently asking in court. They filed a letter on Monday arguing that Merchan's going to have to recuse himself from this case because of a conflict of interest involving his daughter, Lauren Merchan. Here is what Trump defense lawyer Todd Blanch wrote in a court filing in Justice Juan Merchan's courtroom on Monday. Todd Blanch, the Trump lawyer, writes, quote, "Under these circumstances, Your Honor has an interest in this case that warrants recusal. There is an unacceptable risk that the court's family relationships will influence judicial conduct and the court's impartiality might reasonably be questioned." And predictably speaking, of course, Alvin Bragg and the prosecution are having none of it. This is just a snippet of their argument. They write in response, quote, "There is simply nothing new here that would alter this court's prior conclusion that nothing about this proceeding will directly benefit authentic campaigns or this court's family member, let alone this court." So what is authentic campaigns? Well, authentic campaigns is a Democratic political consulting and digital advertising group that has fundraising lists and places digital ads for various campaigns, high profile campaigns. They dealt with the Joe Biden 2020 campaign. Prior to that, they dealt with Kamala Harris's short-lived 2020 presidential campaign. They've dealt with Adam Schiff in his current and past campaigns. And so far, Authentic Campaigns has been paid nearly $12 million so far across the 2023-2024 election cycle. The justice here, Juan Merchan, his daughter, Lauren Merchan, works for Authentic Campaigns. And they have been talking about this case, that is Authentic Campaigns, in their solicitation emails to try to raise additional funds. And in fact, according to the reporting from John Levine, an excellent reporter at the New York Post, Authentic Campaigns has raised up to $93 million by fundraising off of her father's involvement in this case. Now, it turns out that the judge himself, Merchan, had previously donated very small dollar amounts to Democratic candidates in the past. And going back to last year, it was on those grounds that Trump's lawyers had first sought to get Merchan recused from this case. Merchan himself cited an advisory opinion from New York's Advisory Committee on Judicial Ethics just about a year ago now in May 2023. He relied on that opinion to determine that, quote, his impartiality cannot reasonably be questioned. Trump's lawyers are basically now doubling down on this argument now that we have these latest revelations about the daughter and her involvement with Authentic Campaigns. We will see where it ends. Ultimately, I do not predict that the justice is going to recuse himself. There are not many bright line rules here. It's difficult to have bright line rules. Most of it ends up being relatively subjective. And ultimately, there's not really much of an enforcement mechanism. That's the key point here. Ultimately, the judge really has to be the one to recuse him or herself from the case. You're not going to get a third party that swoops in and convinces someone that he or she has to be recused. That's just not the way it works. These are subjective gray area decisions, and unfortunately, there probably just isn't a better way to do it. Now, when I see a story like this, my first instinct is to be initially somewhat skeptical, as I was sharing on Newsmax earlier this week, is to be somewhat skeptical because I have seen what's happened for so many years with Justice Clarence Thomas and his wife, Ginni Thomas, and how lefties from ProPublica and all these other horrible Democrat lawfare complex-funded media hit jobs get up in their breeches and start to argue that Justice Clarence Thomas is ethically and financially compromised because of his wife, Ginni Thomas's activities doing XYZ things. Ginni is a well-known conservative activist. She has been for a very long time. She's very good at what she does, by the way. My intuition is to be somewhat skeptical when I see stories like this. But this really does feel quite a bit different, doesn't it? Where you have the judge, and by the way, I can't emphasize this enough, is the judge overseeing the first ever criminal prosecution of a former president. Period. So already we're in a difference in kind, not difference in degree sort of comparison when it comes to Clarence Thomas and Ginni Thomas. So you have the first ever criminal prosecution of a former president, and the daughter is working for a company making tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars in campaign donations based off of the fact, soliciting that money and raising that money for her clients based off the fact that she is the daughter of the judge in this case. Feels quite icky, doesn't it? And it is exactly this sort of stuff, along with the sort of stuff that we were talking on the show yesterday, the senior judge in Washington, D.C., Reggie Walton, going on CNN to spew his anti-Trump blather on air. It is exactly this sort of stuff that undermines the public faith and trust in the judicial system in this country, which at a time of exceedingly low confidence in the rule of law in all the institutions that matter is a very, very risky and indeed profoundly dangerous possibility. And I don't ultimately predict that Merchan's going to recuse himself, but it seems to me like he darn well should, because the optics here, especially given the fact that it is the first prosecution of a former president, it feels icky. That's it for today's deep dive. Up next in today's closing argument, let's take a brief look at what's going on out in Oregon. Interesting stuff out there. We'll be right back.
I'm Mike Slater from the podcast Politics by Faith. This is a crazy time in our country. It's stressful, a lot of anxiety, and it's going to get worse. And I realized that one of the things that helps me take away the stress is realizing that there's nothing new under the sun. So on this podcast, we take the news of the day and we run it through the Bible and other periods in history to realize that we've been through this before and we can rise above again. Politics by Faith, anywhere you listen to the podcast. Politics by Faith.
Welcome back. It's time for today's closing argument. So when you think about Oregon, you probably think about the city of Portland, which is the largest city out there. And you probably think about BLM. You probably think about Antifa. And certainly all of that was happening and more. Back in 2020, the so-called Summer of Love, after the death of George Floyd, when protesters and vandalizers and rioters ended up burning through America's urban corridors to the tune of at least $1 or $2 billion in estimated property damage based on insurance claims. Well, something else happened down in Oregon in the summer of 2020, which is that Oregon voters voted on Measure 110, which 58% of Oregonians supported in the year 2020. And that had the effect of decriminalizing methamphetamine, heroin, and other hard drugs. It decriminalized them such that possession would only get you a $100 fine. And then you could have someone reach out to encourage that you seek treatment or things like that. Well, in a not particularly shocking turn of events, it hasn't gone very well. Drug legalization, drug decriminalization never goes well. Again, I lived in Colorado for a year. I saw the results of this myself. Oregon in 2023, just in the first 6 months of the year 2023, Oregon recorded 628 fatal opioid overdoses. That is up from 280 over the course of the entire year in 2018. And it got so bad from a basic quality of life perspective that a poll from this past August found that 56% of Oregonians wanted to repeal Measure 110 for all the reasons that you would expect, because quality of life, crime, homelessness, general just sense of public safety, all of it just got so much worse. And it's just a reminder that the rule of law is not just prescriptive. It's not just descriptive. It is a teacher. It is a habituator. It is an inculcator of sound Republican habits of mind. And it can and should be used not merely as kind of a law and economics-esque incentive to do and not do better things moving forward, but it also should try to be a teacher. I'll nerd out just for a second here. If you'll indulge me, there was a wonderful article maybe 40, 50 years ago from a University of Chicago political science professor named Ralph Lerner called Judges as Republican Schoolmasters. And the idea here, whether it applies to judges, legislators, or anyone else, is that you can use the rule of law as a teacher. This is an older conception of the rule of law. It is not just there to promote the most efficient outcome, even though that was largely what we learned in my legal alma mater at the University of Chicago Law School. It is not just there for maximal efficiency. It is also there to do substantive justice and to be used as a teacher to sculpt mores and, as I said, to inculcate sound Republican habits of mind. And drug decriminalization, drug legalization do, of course, the exact opposite of that. So Oregon, which is a Democrat-dominated state, Democrat governor, Democrat-dominated legislature, they listened to the people and they recriminalized hard drug possession. Governor Tina Kotek signed the legislation into law on Monday. Good for Oregon. I hope that that is a sign of things to come. Many people say the so-called war on drugs has been a failure. These people, frankly, just don't know what they are talking about. In any event, that's it for today's episode of America on Trial with Josh Hammer. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. We'll be right back with you tomorrow morning.